27th of April. We're about 5 minutes late in starting. I apologize. We'll begin today with a public hearing on House Bill 2995. We'll open that public hearing, and we invite Representative Galizio to come forward. And Representative Galizio, you have Robin Christensen, Sybil Hebb, and Matt Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wow, everyone looks a lot more attractive from this perspective. Except for Representative Pass. That's okay.
Boy, I could go along.
Mr. Chair, with that tie on, don't even talk.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Larry Galizio, House District 35, and here in support of House Bill 2995. Concerning refund anticipation loans, and you should have a lot of paper going around, and I'll get to that in a second. But first, before I start, I just wanted to thank the chair who's been working on this bill since the last session, or at least refund anticipation loans since last session. I also wanted to recognize that my colleague, Representative Esquivel, is also co-sponsor of the bill, and a lot of hard work on by Representative Jackie Dingfelder as well, and also been working closely with Paul Cosgrove and Matt Marquis, representing HSBC and H&R Block, respectively. So we've had quite a good working group on this bill, and the timing, I think, is very fortuitous, as will be made clear. I'm going to try to be brief, because we have people who will be testifying who I think represent elements of the community that are going to be really important to hear. So you'll hear oral testimony in support of 2995 from Robin Christian, who's the executive director of Children First for Oregon, Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center, Max Mueller, who's legislative assistant to Representative Dingfelder. And as you're being inundated with paper, there's written testimony in support from Philip Kennedy Wong of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, and also Bob Castagna just came in today and I think might be testifying on it as well. You also should have from Justin Baxter, the chair of the Oregon State Bar Consumer Law Section, support, and Rick Bennett, who's associate state director of advocacy for AARP. So really briefly, refund anticipation loans, and you might hear the acronym RAL or RALS. Refund anticipation loans are high-cost, short-term loans that are secured against a borrower's income tax refund. And presently, RALS, or refund anticipation loans, are unregulated. They're largely unregulated in Oregon. And again, you'll hear more specifically about how they work, but if you're due a refund of, let's say, $1,200, you can access that money through a loan sort of immediately. But again, the details will be forthcoming. The timing on this is really fortuitous. Number one, Senator Gordon Smith just this past week has introduced a bill at the federal level, and it's Senate Bill, I've lost it. Where is it?
832.
There it is. And so this has gotten the attention. It's gotten national attention. And if I could just take a quote from Senator Gordon Smith's press release, it says, RALS can be helpful for families in tight financial situations, but these costs are outrageous and they take advantage of people desperate for money. We need to make sure people understand what they're getting into. And that's the key. The House Bill 2995 is really focused on transparency and providing information so that consumers and citizens can make the best choices possible. This bill is about transparency and providing information. So we also have good timing in that yesterday out of this committee we passed the Earned Income Tax Credit with a refund. And currently in Oregon, 25% of Oregon families receiving the earned income tax credit use refund anticipation loans. So these are lower income folks who are benefiting from the earned income tax credit, but then using the refund anticipation loan and often paying very high fees and losing some of that money. So the timing, I think, is very fortuitous. So I think what I would like to do is just hand it over to you. Will you go first? Okay. And if I can answer any questions, I'd be glad to.
Thank you, Representative Galizio. We're appreciated.
Good afternoon, Chair Butler and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robin Christian. I am the Executive Director of Children First for Oregon. Children First for Oregon is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to protecting and strengthening the health and well-being of Oregon's children and families. We work to inform decision makers, the media, and the general public about the issues impacting children, and we offer solutions that constitute sound policy choices and smart investments. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 2995. You have a copy of my testimony and our one-page fact sheet in front of you, hopefully. So I would like to just highlight a few points. The financial stability of families is a priority issue for us. More than one in three children in Oregon live in poverty or in financially vulnerable households. The earned income tax credit helps low-income working families. The federal EITC provides much-needed tax relief and cash support to low-income families in Oregon. EITC refunds are also good for the Oregon economy. There are some charts attached to my testimony that will give you some additional information about that. Refund anticipation loans reduce the effectiveness of EITC. Nearly 25% of Oregon families receiving an earned income tax credit use refund anticipation loans. The goal of House Bill 2995 is to improve consumer protections so families can make informed financial decisions. Surveys show that many refund anticipation loan consumers don't know they are loans or don't understand the extra fees associated with them. RALs are completely unregulated in Oregon. We support House Bill 2995 because we believe it improves disclosure, it defines who can do them, licensed professionals only, and it makes violation of the law an unfair trade practice. House Bill 2995 is good for cash-strapped families and their children. It promotes informed financial decision-making. Some families will continue to use RALs, but with House Bill 2995, they will do so with the guarantee that they have all the facts and are making an informed decision. We support amendments to House Bill 2995 that would add pertinent provisions from House Bill 3347 related to disclosure and who can facilitate these loans. We encourage you to support House Bill 2995 with a due pass recommendation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Robin. Sybil, why don't we have you go next, please?
Sorry for the arrangement here. My name is Sybil Hebb. I'm the legislative advocate for the Oregon Law Center. The Oregon Law Center is a civil legal services provider. We provide free legal assistance to low-income Oregonians across the state. Our clients are people who are generally within 125% of the federal poverty level. For a family of four, that translates into an annual income of about $24,000 a year. So our clients are families who are struggling on a daily basis and who are generally one paycheck away from potentially missing a rent payment or missing a car payment, and they're consistently struggling with these issues and to maintain food on the table for their kids. And this is the population, as you all know, that Congress had in mind when it passed the earned income tax credit way back in 1975. And so that's the population that receives a benefit from that important tax credit. It's unfortunately a benefit that has been reduced by the proliferation of RALs in Oregon. And so for those reasons, we're really supportive of the fact that this bill with the -1 amendments provides some regulation to the RAL industry industry that will make sure that consumers are able to make informed decisions and able to better plan for themselves and their families. Okay. Specifically, we're concerned because the RALs are, in Oregon, marketed as rapid refund loans. And we think that that has preyed on the fact that many consumers are simply unaware that they are currently able to receive refunds in a rapid fashion through electronic filing for free. And there are many resources throughout the state that will help consumers to file their funds electronically, file their refund requests electronically for free. And when I asked, when I reached out to look for some information about where those services were located, I received about 10 to 12 pages of faxes with addresses listed where those services are available for free throughout the state. And so it's really something that consumers have the ability to access easily. They don't know it, and we can do a better job of publicizing that, but the refund anticipation loan industry has been successful in marketing and taking advantage of the fact that consumers are unaware that they have that ability currently. We've also been concerned because refund anticipation loans are extremely expensive, and we've heard it said that refund anticipation loans are essentially luring consumers in to pay a high price to borrow their own money. This is a refund to which they're entitled. It's a very secure refund. It's coming, from the federal government, and so there's not a lot of risk for the lender. And so the prices that are charged seem a bit out of touch with the risk that's involved. Our interest in the bill is that it provides disclosure of the fees and costs that are charged so that consumers are aware. It also provides disclosure that there is the availability of free electronic filing for consumers, so they know that they have that other option. The other requirement of the bill with the Dash 1 amendments, of which we're very supportive, is the fact that it requires that the preparers be licensed tax preparers, and we believe that ensures a consistent level of quality and professionalism amongst the people who are providing the loans, and so I think that's an important benefit for consumers as well. We're also supportive of the fact that in order to implement these policies and these procedures, there be enforcement mechanisms laid out specifically in the law, and so we appreciate that as well. We think this will have a great impact on low-income consumers in that it will help them to make better decisions for themselves, and we very much appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ed. Max Moore?
Good afternoon, Chair Butler and members of the committee. My name is Max Muller, and I'm legislative aide to Representative Jackie Dingfelder. She unfortunately couldn't be here today. She's got a bill up in the Water Committee, which is meeting right now. So I've come in her place and am testifying on her behalf in favor of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2995. And my purpose here is to tell you some of the nuances of this bill, some of the finer points that distinguish it from the other refund anticipation loan bill, which you will hear in a few minutes, House Bill 3347. That's also on your agenda today. And so first let me outline the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2995, which we're in favor of. The three main things that this bill will do are require full disclosure of loan terms so that the borrowers can make informed decisions about whether or not to obtain a loan. It would require that facilitators of the loans be licensed as tax preparers or accountants. And that would ensure that the facilitators of these loans meet the high conduct standards of those two industries, accountants and tax preparers. It would also specify that violations of those first two requirements are unlawful trade practices, which make it enforceable by state authorities and by civil action. House Bill 3347, the other refund anticipation loan bill which you'll hear today, is similar, but we believe it's weaker and will be less effective. Because it would exclude the primary enforcement mechanism in this bill. It would preempt all local jurisdictions in Oregon from enacting their own laws based on the local circumstances in their jurisdictions. And as written, the bill would also exclude accountants who are currently providing refund anticipation loans. The bill, HB 3347, would exclude them from being able to do that in the future. So we're supportive of HB 2995. We think that's the better solution. And I'd just now like to elaborate a little bit on these differences. The first issue is the form and timing of the disclosures of the terms of the refund anticipation loan. The major purpose of both bills and all refund anticipation loan bills is to establish in state statute that facilitators of the loans must clearly disclose loan terms, and we think that's a very reasonable request. And both of the bills recognize that currently there's actually a federal law, the Unfair Trade, or the Truth in Lending Act, which requires some disclosures, but it doesn't require disclosures specific to the refund anticipation loan industry, and we think there are additional disclosures that need to be required. Also, the existence of a federal law doesn't ensure that it's enforced at the state level, and the fact that two-thirds of borrowers aren't even aware that they're getting a loan indicates that the federal law is not enough, and we need a law in Oregon that's enforceable in this state. The disclosures that are required by the bills are that the refund anticipation loan is in fact a loan, so that people are aware that they're actually paying to borrow money. They must disclose the time period in which the proceeds of the loan will be paid into the account of the borrower. Facilitators must disclose the average time in which the taxpayer could expect to obtain their refund if they didn't get a loan. And they must disclose that electronic filing is available even if they don't get a loan. So they can't be misled into thinking that in order to get to electronically file, they need to get a refund anticipation loan. And there are some other disclosures as well. Both bills also require that the disclosures be made on a piece of paper that the borrower can take home with them and think about. And we think that's very important. Obtaining a refund anticipation loan is generally a two-step process. The borrower first goes to the tax preparer, gets their taxes done, and applies for the loan. The facilitator sends the application to a bank, which actually checks the borrower's credit and sends the application back to the facilitator. And then at a second meeting, the borrower and the facilitator consummate the loan. And we think that, it's very important for the disclosures to be made at the first meeting, the meeting when the borrower applies for the loan, because we think that's the most formative meeting when the borrower makes the decision about whether or not to obtain a loan.
So
far, everything I've said about the disclosures in the two bills are the same, but there are some key differences, and we think they're very important. House Bill 2995, which we're talking about now and we're supporting, would require that. It has several additional requirements about the form the disclosures must take. It says that the disclosures have to be grouped together as opposed to being spread out in multiple documents, that they be kept separate from other information like ads or other application materials. These requirements about the nature of the disclosures are consistent with federal law, the Federal Truth in Lending Act, that lenders are already required to comply with. But as we've said already, the federal law has proved to be insufficient, and we need to make this disclosure requirement enforceable in Oregon. So with regard to enforcement, if disclosure requirements in any bill are to be effective, they need to be enforceable, and both HB 3347 and HB 2995 would allow the State Board of Tax Preparers to assess civil penalties to violators and to suspend or deny the license of tax preparers. But HB 2995, which we're discussing now, has an additional enforcement, and we think that that's going to prove to be the strongest and the most important in enforcing the law. And that is that HB 2995 would stipulate that violations of the disclosure requirements are unlawful trade practices. The unlawful trade practices statutes in Oregon law have two parts. It allows the Attorney General to investigate and recover the cost of their investigation and enjoin the unlawful practice. And it also, more importantly, has a civil right of action. And that would allow a violated borrower to pursue the matter themselves in court. And they can recover attorney's fees and recover actual damages. And since it takes a state bureaucracy they have to receive a certain number of complaints before they investigate, but we think the civil right of action is very important because individuals can pursue action themselves the first time a violation occurs. And you should have a letter from Justin Baxter on your desk. He's the chair of the consumer law section at the Oregon State Bar, in which he elaborates on the virtues of the unfair trade practices statutes and why that's an appropriate enforcement mechanism for this bill. I'd just like to talk a little bit about preemption also. House Bill 3347, unlike House Bill 2995, would preempt local authorities from enacting their own refund anticipation loan laws. And we disagree with that. We are in favor of local control because we think that there could be local circumstances that would require a different law, and we think that cities and counties should have the right to make their own laws if they think that's fit. Having said that,
Max, do you think they ought to be able to also license tax preparers too locally? Wouldn't they be able to do that then too?
I do not think so, but I think that the nature of refund anticipation loan clients, they tend to be low income. If a certain area had a demographic with lots of low income people and the there was just more exploitation going on in that area, I could see a local jurisdiction needing to enact tougher refund anticipation loan laws than the state law. The state law is simply a disclosure requirement with enforcement. And who knows? We favor local control. We don't want to preempt anyone.
Well, if you favor local control, and you ought to favor local control as to who prepares the tax return.
I'm not sure that that is the same kind of issue. I think that the problem right now with refund anticipation loans is that there's clearly so much misinformation going around that local jurisdictions need to maintain their right to address this. We think that if the existence of a state law is going to take the wind out of the sails of local efforts, because right now, if any cities are pursuing it, they're pursuing it because Oregon doesn't have a state law, and once a state law is enacted, we think that there won't be many local efforts. Even if there are local efforts to make a refund anticipation loan law, and tax preparers have to comply with different jurisdictions, we think that they already have to comply with different jurisdictions, you know, municipal tax laws, county tax laws, state tax laws, special districts taxes. They have to customize all their forms to adjust these things, and we think that asking them to customize their disclosures is not a enormous extra burden. So, in conclusion, we believe that House Bill 2995 is the best solution to the disclosure problems associated with refund anticipation loans. The bill has more thorough disclosure requirements, it has better enforcement, and it doesn't preempt local control. The bill is a result of a collaborative effort that took place over many months and incorporated the suggestions of the tax preparation industry, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and many consumer advocates. We consulted with H&R Block in the drafting stage of this bill, and we actually adopted nearly all of their suggestions in the Dash 1 amendments. The amendments before you, the Dash 1 amendments, were supported by Representative Dingfelder, Representative Galizio, representatives of the State Bar, Children First for Oregon, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, and the Oregon Law Center. We believe that the Dash 1 amendments are necessary, and we urge you to support them. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Max, while you've been giving your testimony, Representative Dingfelder is in the room. Representative Dingfelder, would you like to come forward? You've done a great deal of work on this. Admire your work. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jackie Dingfelder. I'm state representative for House District 45, and I apologize. We had a bill up in the Water Committee, so I didn't want to leave before that bill.
Max told us you were at it all.
Playing hooky. No. I was in the Water Committee. But my staff did an excellent job at sharing with you. He's worked very hard and has worked on all the different bills, as you've heard. But he's shared with you the issues that have been raised during discussions for many, many months about this. And I really appreciate, first of all, the fact that you're having these hearings on these different bills. As you know, there's a discussion going on at the Senate level as well, and there's a hearing tomorrow, a work session on Senate Bill 968. So we're hopeful that we'll be able to have either a bill in the House or Senate that addresses many of the issues that Max has raised here today. So I appreciate as you go forward with your deliberations. I won't be able to stay because I have to go back to my committee. I just wanted to check up and make sure my staff wasn't misleading you, and I have to say it did an excellent job. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Chair. Just a couple things. I mean, one of the challenges when you work with a variety of groups is, you know, you're trying to competing. You know, in discussion with H&R Block, with Matt Marquis of H&R Block and Paul Cosgrove from HSBC, I mean, we want to get a bill that's going to work and get through this body. So there is some flexibility. First of all, I want to say that this bill with the Dash 1 amendment is less onerous than the bill coming from the federal level, Senator Smith, which is a bipartisan bill. But having said that, I mean, again, the focus is really on disclosure. And we just want to make sure that there's a separate written disclosure, and H&R Block is fine with that. And quite frankly, it's not really the H&R Blocks and HSBCs that we're concerned about. What we're concerned about are folks that maybe have more sort of fly-by-night shops that are not institutionalized. Those are the people that we're really most concerned about. H&R Block and HSBC have been great to work with. And in terms of the enforcement, I know there's a push for unfair trade practices, and we've been discussing that, and I think there's some, you know, there's obviously some room for flexibility there, as with preemption. But so I just wanted to, for the record, make sure that's clear.
Questions from members of the committee to the testifiers today? Thank you very much. You've all...
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to add that I really want to thank Senator Gordon Smith's office also for taking the leadership on this issue. I'm sure, hopefully you all received the press release. I wish I could say that we've been working together on this and really coordinated the timing, but we were very happy to hear that the senator is also looking at this at the federal level. And we're also pleased to see that we were very consistent in the approach that we were taking with what is being looked at in Congress. So once again, I really appreciate your consideration of this very important issue.
Thank you very much. Let's see. We also have then Bob Castagna.
Thank you, Chair Butler, members of the committee. For the record, Robert J. Castagna, General Counsel and Executive Director of the Oregon Catholic Conference. The Oregon Catholic Conference represents the Catholic Bishops of Oregon in service to Oregon's Catholic population of more than 425,000 Oregonians in support of the common good for all Oregonians. We want to go on record today in support of House Bill 2995. We join with Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon in our support of the bill, and we think that the combination of House Bill 2995 with what this committee did yesterday in the passage of House Bill 2046 on the refundable earned income tax credit will further enhance the ability of low-income working families to truly maximize the benefits of 2046 and the refundable earned income tax credit. I was out of state on business yesterday, and I wasn't here when you passed out 2046, but I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and the members of this committee for your action yesterday. And I also want to thank your staff, Elizabeth Martin Marr, for the staff report that she did before the session started to get this ball rolling. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Castagna? Thank you, Bob. And Matt Marquis and Paul Cosgrove. Is Paul here yet? Okay. Matt, are you going to be testifying on behalf of the Dash 1?
How about the two bills in general, including some amendments yet to come?
Okay.
Hopefully. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing H&R Block today. H&R Block has over 1,000 employees and 137 offices in Oregon. Last year, we prepared over 163,000 Oregon residents' taxes, and we prepare about one out of every seven individual federal tax returns nationally. This year marks H&R Block's 50th anniversary. We're proud to offer our clients quality tax preparation, financial advice, low-cost saving products, and alerts to government benefits like child health insurance, food stamps, and school lunch programs. We assist low-income Oregonians in claiming over $87 million in federal earned income tax credits, which benefit our clients and the community throughout the state. I have submitted written testimony and will try to briefly summarize our views on refund loans and the bills before the committee today in a few points. First, refund anticipation loans, or RALs, serve as a real need for a lot of people. Many taxpayers need or want access to their federal tax return faster than the IRS can provide it, which can take from anywhere from 8 to 56 days. Many need to pay overdue bills to avoid late fees and damaged credit ratings, and to make emergency car repairs or home repairs, and sometimes even avoid eviction. The products provide speed, convenience, and security for an additional fee. Second, RALs are already highly regulated. Eight federal laws, including the Truth in Lending Act, and extensive IRS rules also regulate RALs. IRS e-filers must undergo FBI criminal background checks, fingerprinting, a credit check, and an IRS compliance review. There are disclosure requirements and restrictions on advising and fees. Facilitators are also subject to anti-fraud and deception practices laws. IRS and RAL lenders receive few complaints about RALs, and we know of no documented pattern in abuse in RAL facilitation. Third, H&R Block strongly supports and practices full disclosure of all refund anticipation loans. We want our clients to understand all their options before no fee added IRS refund and fee and such products are offered. We objectively present these with layered disclosures covering costs, times, and responsibility. If you look at this right here, I'm going to briefly go through a few of the disclosures at H&R Block. They always start off with a welcome handout that goes through all options of refunds, and they always start by first offering anything, no fee added IRS options are always shown first. And then they're given a fax about RALs presented to each client considering a RAL fully, and it fully discloses that a RAL is a loan and not the client's IRS refund. It features important characteristics of the loan, responsibility of the borrower in a full fee and APR schedule, timelines, and transaction examples. And if you look on, I guess the pages aren't numbered here, but if you look at table one, it clearly states exactly how much each type of refund anticipation loan costs for the dollar amount of the loan. It gives the APR of each loan, and it also shows the total APRs. And then a side-by-side comparison of all options with information specific to the client's own refund, including all fees and APRs, are shown on a shared computer screen. So the first table shows, in general, specific examples of a loan. On the next page, you will see a printout of a computer screen that shows the exact fees involved for the person seeking a RAL. The bank's full truth and lending disclosures are in the application, which clearly states that the RAL is a loan and has the word loan in capital letters 2 inches high and 7.5 inches across the page. Earlier you heard that two-thirds of people don't know that this is a loan, and I don't know how that could happen. If you look at the actual printout here of the application, it's pretty clear that the word loan is written right across the application. Finally, we caution clients in our customized Block Advantage report, which is one of the last pages in your handout, of ways of planning in the future to help avoid any types of need for these types of loans in the future. We believe that full disclosure is the cornerstone of effective consumer protection, and we provide such disclosures about refund loans to ensure that our clients can make an informed decision about these products. Regarding the two bills before you today, we strongly support providing full and fair disclosures to all RAL customers. Both bills contain important provisions holding all RAL facilitators to the same high standards, informing consumers about the features of the loan, the rights of the and obligations of the borrower and the lender, and the alternatives available for receiving a federal tax refund. We also support provisions in the bill that would ensure a uniform state standard and prevent a patchwork of conflicting county and municipal legislation in this area. All Oregon consumers deserve the same high level of protection. Mr. Chair, if the committee moves forward in this area, we look forward to continuing our work with Representative Galizio and the chair to ensure that we can continue to use the best practices disclosures we have described here, and that Oregon consumers are both fully informed and well protected. You also heard earlier today that a lot of these fees are outrageous, and I just want to point out a couple of examples. People in America tend to pay for things so that they can get it quicker. Just one example being, if you were to mail something, it costs 37 cents. If you want to take that same package and overnight it, it will cost you $13.65. Western Union, if you want to wire transfer money on a $3,000 allotment, would cost you $139 to wire that. A $3,000 RAL would only cost you about $100. So there are lots of examples I could get into where consumers pay for speedy service. These are just a few. But now I've tried my best here to answer any questions if there are any.
Thank you, Matt. Questions, members of the committee? Representative Hass is recognized.
Thank you. I appreciate your disclosures on this thing. Now, is this something that when someone comes in one of those booths you have set up or your office, do you give them one of these?
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, our current practices right now, all these disclosures are currently done on a shared computer screen. You sit across from the tax preparer, and the computer screen is in the middle of you. You're both looking at it, going over all the disclosures on the computer screen.
They don't get
this handout. We are currently working with Representative Galizio and the chair on language that would put into writing a lot of these disclosures. If you look at, again, this table, the language that we are talking about now would put this table into a written format so that every individual would have something to take home that would show exactly how much in fees they would pay for any given loan amount, what the APR is, what the interest rate is, and what the fee charges are.
If I may, Mr. Chair, so then they have to read off of the preparer's computer screen the disclosure and the information about this.
Currently, Mr. Chair, Representative Pass, that's how it works.
Representative Berger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions are along the same line. Tell me how much of the requirements in the bill are they fully met with this, or is there more in the bill that would have to be added to this? This seems very complete to me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, the big difference is I think pretty much all the information that's in the bill is contained in the disclosures in this packet. The big difference is the way that the bill is written, you're going to be looking at it in a written format rather than electronic version. And that's been a sticking point a little bit, but we've been working with the proponents of the bill to come up with a solution that works for everybody.
Follow up, Representative.
Yeah, in reading the bill, and I frankly have read it as we were sitting here, and it seems to me that this, along with a single sheet of paper that would check off, yes, I read and understand, would probably meet the requirements of the bill. Am I correct in that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I'm not 100% sure, but I think thereafter and particularly under the Dash 1 amendments, are looking for written disclosures that a consumer could take home with them rather than a checkoff sheet.
Well,
Representative,
two copies, one for you and one for the consumer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, yeah, I suppose that's correct.
I'm just trying to get at what's different between this and what's in the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
And I understand this is electronic, and that is part of the issue, but what piece of paper on top of this would, and maybe the framers of the bill need to be.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, again, it's the biggest difference is written versus electronically, and I think we're getting very close to a compromise that will work for everybody on what needs to be written and not just on a computer screen.
Good news.
Representative Comp.
Thank you, Chairman Butler. Matt, there's a phrase on here. I gotta ask what it means on page 6. It actually, your pages are numbered. It's on the settlement option screen. What is the peace of mind fee?
That's this page here?
Page 6, right up the top. There's tax prep and other fees. You know, so it shows, and right above it, the next above line is peace of mind fee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, I'll have to get back to you on that. I don't know. I've never actually sat down and gone through this process, but I do see it's zero, so apparently there was no fee involved in that. I don't know what it is,
right,
though. I will get back to you as soon as with that information.
Well, it's a great line, because if there's a fee, I'd pay it if I could get it.
As would I.
We signed up the whole committee.
Yeah.
Right.
Everyone that's on the prize. And then I do have a follow-up. It's been alluded to in the testimony that people that have an earned income credit refund would possibly be able to, would be somebody that might maximize this type of a loan. 20% of all taxpayers in my house district qualify for that earned income credit. And I don't have the statistics on how many of those people do not read English but only speak Spanish would be appreciable. Is this going to be done electronically? It's kind of what Representative Berger is saying about understanding it in another language other than English, possibly in the future.
Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, that's not an issue that's come up yet in our discussions, but I would assume that a tax preparer in a district like yours that does have a lot of multiculturalism, mm-hmm. different languages, that would be to their benefit to offer that service to
right.
them.
I'm just putting it as a seed.
Gotcha.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Reddick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to see there's one piece in the bill, or at least it, as it would be amended, with that says you have to let folks know that electronic filing is available free, and that's a piece I don't see in here. I don't believe,
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, and I was looking for that just before I sat down. And if you look at the first page, it talks about the H&R client's welcome brochure on page 2. That's supposed to be the next page. And I just picked this up from the printer, and it's not there, and I don't know why it's not there. But that lists all your options of no fees. It starts off saying, here's how you can get your taxes or your tax refund. Without a fee, you can do an e-file and get a direct deposit, or it can be mailed to you. The timelines involved in that, that's in the welcome brochure. On the table itself, this one here, again, on table 2, it talks about a paper return, an e-filed return, and how many days that will take, and whether or not you have to pay preparation fees up front, and if there's any other fees involved.
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you. The other thing I wanted to ask is, it appears to me, given that you know, H&R Block pretty much has everything in place to do this, and I don't think it's H&R Block that we're really concerned about. What's your feeling about that comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, I appreciate that, and H&R Block has only been a client a short time of ours, and from what I have gathered up to this date, I can tell you they do their best to make sure that all disclosures are done promptly and properly. I can't speak to the other people out there that do loans because I just don't have any experience in how they offer these loans to people. With this language, I would everybody's under the same playing field, though.
Thank you. Other questions of Matt? Matt, can you hold up, please, if you would, please? The actual HSBC application for refund with the 2-inch high letters to say loan on. That did not copy through on ours.
It did not. Mr. Chair, it is this page right here, and I don't know if you can see from there or not, but
I can see
in 2-inch letters, it states loan right across the top of the page.
Here's what mine looks like.
Ah, I apologize.
It just didn't copy through. It's in green. On yours.
Yes, it is. It is in green, 2 inches, 7.5.
Copied through very lightly in blue on.
I apologize for that.
No,
Mr.
that's
Chair.
Fine. I'm sure it's probably on the original form. It's probably very readable.
It is. And on the loan, it's even better. I've seen it on the actual loan paper.
Copy of a copy of a copy.
Exactly.
Okay. Other questions of Mr. Markey? Thank you very much.
Thank you,
colleagues. We have side by side with this House Bill 3347. But I'm going to go ahead then and close the public hearing on 2995. Representative Crummell, is he here? Okay, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3378.
3378.
Yeah, I guess.
Recess.
Yeah, I'll recess the hearing on 2995, and we'll come back 2995 in conjunction with 3347, but we'll open a public hearing on 3378 for Representative Crummell. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26, which is Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston, Southern Washington County. And I appreciate you having a hearing on House Bill 3378. And, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure of your intentions, whether you'll recess this one or not, but there are some other folks in the room that would like to testify on this bill as well, so whatever your pleasure is in that regards. Thank you for moving this up. House Bill 3378 is a concept that was brought to me a number of years ago by a fellow by the name of Dick Anderson, who works for Fannie Mae, and actually Dick is here and will testify for the bill. I think that we've introduced this bill before, and I think it just sometimes takes a while for a good idea to sort of percolate through the system. But what House Bill 3378 does is it creates a tax credit for employers who offer home purchase assistance to their employees. This is a benefit that more and more employers are starting to utilize to recruit employees, and is a tool that we could certainly aid employers by providing. Assistance in the bill is described as financial contributions towards closing costs, earnest rate buy-downs, earnest money deposits, any other costs specifically related to a purchase transaction. It also imposes a ceiling on the amount that can be allowed for any calendar year by the Department of Revenue. It imposes a ceiling for the amount any one taxpayer may claim in a year. The other thing is that a credit may not be more than what a taxpayer would pay in any one year. So there are some specific parts in here that I think are important to note. And with regards to the ceiling for all taxpayers during the calendar year, you'll notice on lines 18 and 19 of page 1 of the bill that those lines are blank. And it's kind of up to you folks to fill in the blanks and see what you think is there. Granted, I realize that maybe I should have done that myself, but no, I'd rather leave it to you because I think it's something that is more in your expertise. A taxpayer would have to apply to the Department of Revenue for a credit certification, and then applications are granted in chronological order up to the annual limitation for all taxpayers. And then certificates can be carried forward for up to 3 years. For the state tax, a deduction may not be claimed if the credit is used, and for federal tax purposes, any deduction claimed must be added back as taxable income for state tax purposes. And so we've done that so that there's not a double dipping for the opportunity for the employers to be able to take on this. They can apply for the credit period. And then I think what's important is to let you know why this bill is important. This is going to help especially first-time home buyers get into the market. And as we have discovered in Oregon, house rates are going up. And one of the reasons why they go up and one of the reasons why they are artificially going up is because of our land use laws. But that's not the purview of this committee. The purview of this committee is to determine whether or not this bill would be a good idea. It will allow employers to use this as a recruiting tool, and I think that's extremely important, and I mentioned that when I first opened. It enables people that have a lower income be able to leverage their earnings for home ownership. And I think that this is something, people look at their, they might be paying $700 or $800 a month in rent, and they don't see themselves being able to buy a home because they're not able to get that down payment saved up. This is a way that a person could actually leverage themselves to be able to get into a home and get some assistance and find that their house payment isn't any higher than the rent that they're paying already. And I think that this is a way that we can help people with ownership. And studies have shown, some of the other folks to follow me will allude to this fact, that studies have shown that people who own their own homes tend to stay in the communities in which they live, and they tend to take pride in the community in which they live because they do have that vested interest. And as we talk about what people need to do for retirement and that sort of thing, one of the best investments a person can make is real estate. And the first investment that they need to make is in their own home, so that they really understand what home ownership is all about. The realtors are in strong support of this. We have other groups that are in strong support of this bill as well. And, Mr. Chair, it's good public policy whose time has come. And I hope that the committee will look favorably on this idea and pass this bill on. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Crummell. Any questions for Representative Crummell from members of the committee? Let's see, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Crummell, you may not be in a position to answer these questions, so I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm curious, is there somewhere a record of how many companies do this kind of thing where they help an employee buy a home? It's something that I've always associated with big companies that do it for big executives who are already making big dollars when they relocate, and I'm a little concerned that that's what's going to be helped by this, rather than the folks who are going to go to work for Home Depot, and they may need it desperately, but I just want to know if Home Depot's going to come to the plate here. Do you understand what I'm asking?
I do. Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, and thank you for the question. I think, and it's a very appropriate question to ask, because as we know, as you mentioned, the big executives many times are are folks that they get housing help and that sort of thing, and meanwhile the clerk that's on the front line, gets paid, 10, 12, maybe 15 bucks an hour and a little bit of health insurance help, and that's about it. One of the reasons why Mr. Anderson had brought this idea to me is because he was seeing companies, and so I think I'm hoping he's going to be in a better position to answer that question than I am because of the line of work that he's in. But that there are companies that really do want to help their employees that are in a rental situation be able to get into a home because they will tend to stay on the job. They will tend to stay in the community, and that's really the idea behind this is to help those employees. Now, as far as the actual numbers are concerned, to answer your question very directly, I don't have that information, but I can certainly work with Mr. Anderson to see where we can find that information and get back to you on that. Get back to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Reddick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, it's been a long time since I've been an employee. I've had my own business for a while and no employees, just me. But when I was an employee, it was my recollection that the companies who helped people with their homes typically did so because they wanted to retain that employee. They wanted to move them to a different site, all kinds of things like that. And again, it's similar to what Representative Berger was saying, that tend to be employees that are not on the bottom of the rung, if you know what I mean. And we have lots of ways in this state and other places to help first-time buyers. There are lots of programs to help first-time buyers. And I'm a little concerned about the methodology that we're attempting to use here of having employers be a middleman, if you will. And that concerns me. So why did we choose to have employers as a middleman in this program?
Mr. Chair and Representative Riley, thank you for the question. I guess I don't quite view it as the employer being the middleman. The way I view this, and I've been an employer also, besides who works in my office here. I mean, I've been an employer that's my revenues that are paying the employees. And quite frankly, had there been a program like this in effect when I was an employer, would I have offered this kind of assistance to my employees potentially? And why would I? Because I, especially an employee, and I can think of one right off the top of my head when I was at a clinic in West Salem. This gal that worked for me was very valuable. She really helped me boost my production. And having her there and keeping her there, if this would have been a tool that I could have used to make sure that I could retain her, that somebody else couldn't buy her away, so to speak, then I potentially would have wanted to do that. And, you know, and she was one of those employers that's, you know, making 8, 9, 10, 11 bucks an hour, working hard and everything, and being able to offer this kind of a benefit, I think would have been a real plus.
Thank you. Other questions? I just had a couple of questions. Representative, one, could this could an employer discriminate against higher paid or lower paid employees? And two, does this credit, could it be used, or this credit for an employee be used multiple times over multiple years and move from one location to the next within the same city?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. To your first question on the discrimination issue, no. I don't believe that there would be a way for an employer to discriminate between higher wage employees versus lower wage employees or vice versa.
It's offered for one, it's offered for all.
As far as I know, that would be that. Now, the bill actually at this point is silent on whether or not it could, you know, there's a ceiling in terms of what the employee could be earning. I suppose we could always insert that if we felt that, okay, this is something we really want to make sure that employers are using for their lower paid employees. We certainly could insert that kind of language in there, as long as it would meet any type of constitutional challenges. And I'm not a lawyer. I don't know if it would or not. So that answers your first question. With regards to the second question, which was
number of times for the same employee,
the number of
moves within the work area.
I believe the way the way I've read this and LC drafted it, I believe that what it is that an employer can, let's say an employer said, I'm going to apply for a certificate from Department of Revenue for up to $25,000. And the department then gives them the certificate for up to $25,000. Now, I as an employee could give that, I suppose I could give it to one employee, or the whole $25,000, or I could say to my employees, I've got five people, or, you know, I've got five possibilities that I can, because I'm going to give you $5,000 each. If you decide you want to buy a house, I'm willing to give you a $5,000 bonus, if you will, for towards the purchase of your home. So there would be a couple of different ways. Now, if I'm again, if I'm not correct in that, I would certainly welcome Mr. Anderson to correct me. But that's how I've read it and how I sort of envision it. And so it would be. But and then if an employer didn't use that whole $25,000 in the first year, then it could be then whatever's left over. So let's say you only used 10,000 of it, so you've got 15,000 left. That 15,000 could be carried over to year two, and then whatever he used in year two would be added on to the year one. And then in year three, he could, let's say he used 10,000 again in year two, and then five, so he would still have a $5,000 credit that he could carry over to year three. But if he whatever he didn't use at the end of year three, it's done. If he didn't use $15,000 of the worth of the credit, then by the time year three ended, it's no longer applicable because it's not going to carry forward.
And that credit goes against their either company tax if it's a corporation, or against their individual tax if they're an S corporation or a sole proprietorship partnership.
Yes, correct. Okay.
And final question in that regard: is there any preclusion for this perhaps to be used for family members who are employees? Could an employer gin up some extra credit by having a child move around from home to home that was an employee?
You know, I hadn't thought of that.
Well, I tell you what, you need an accountant.
See, that's why you do what you do and I do what I do.
What's wrong with nepotism?
And so, You know, Mr. Chair, I don't know. And that's, I think that's a very valid question, and we certainly could put a restriction in here to make sure that that's, that, that can't happen.
Okay. Maybe we can invite Dick Anderson from the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, as well as John Gale, to come up and join you from the Oregon Community and Oregon Housing and Community Services.
That'd be great.
Can I revoke your plan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Do you want me to stay here, Mr. Chair?
Whatever you would like to do, you've drawn the short straw already. So
I'll hang out here for a few more minutes, and then I do have to get back to the water.
Thank you, Representative. We recognize you're busy, and we appreciate your time here.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dick Anderson. I am the Anderson spoken of today. I'm employed by a company called Fannie Mae. Actually, our role in the marketplace is to buy mortgage loans. And we don't make them, we buy them from local lenders. And in the state of Oregon, we have over $34 billion worth of mortgage investment in the state. So we're committed to the state of Oregon. Today, though, I'm representing the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. That's an trade association comprised of the local mortgage lenders that actually make the loans. I'm here today to talk to you in support of House Bill 3378. I'm very much aware of the climate in the legislature today regarding the need for revenue to support services that the citizens of Oregon desire and you as legislators believe they need. I do not come here under the illusion that you will be supporting tax credits or the tax credits are even on your priority list. However, I would request that before you tune me out, that you simply think about and listen today with an open mind. After all, tax credits have been approved in each of the legislative sessions that the concept of House Bill 3378 has been introduced. We know for a fact that home ownership provides benefits to a community. The state dollars that we spend on services go further and have deeper results with homeowners. Education dollars. Youth whose parents are homeowners are better educated, they get better grades, and the big key there is the stability of the housing which home ownership provides. Crime is at a lower rate in neighborhoods that are heavy homeowners. I can't think of when the last meth lab was found in a home, an owner home, that typically in rentals. Homeowners are more involved in their communities. Homeowners vote. Homeownership provides the opportunity to build wealth through equity buildup and appreciation. This equity provides asset availability for college education, of which you have approved a tax credit in the past for employers that provide education credit. For startup capital, for small businesses, and yes, even for retirement. Representative Crummell, as a past mayor, has certainly and can certainly attest to the fact that a community with a higher rate of home ownership is a healthier community. It's very desirable to have. On the economic front, as a state, we're spending dollars to attract and retain companies and employers to Oregon. Our housing situation, the availability and affordability, is an issue that negatively affects its economic endeavor. Road congestion, commuting times, are directly related to where people can afford homes. Our own state studies indicate these commuter times are expanding. This impacts clean air, for which we spend money. It impacts parents who have to deal with child care issues or other family issues as they come home from a frazzled drive. Housing and construction has been the primary driver for Oregon economy in the last few legislative sessions. This translates to jobs for people who pay taxes. The state of Oregon continues to grow in population. A recent study even indicated and forecast Oregon to exceed national rate of growth and by year 2030 to be at one of the 10th fastest growing states. More housing means more jobs, which means more revenue to the state. Now the sad news. The state of Oregon is 44th worst state in the union when it comes to home ownership rate. When this piece of legislation concept was brought last session, state of Oregon was 42nd, yes. In 1970, the state was 30th. In 80, it was 36th. In 90, it was 40th. This isn't a good trend. Additionally, Oregonians, working Oregonians, are increasingly being priced out of home ownership opportunity. It is just that in just about every community in Oregon, the value of the housing stock has increased at an alarmingly high rate. Now, that's good for existing homeowners, but it's really tough for your sons and daughters and mine who are attempting to buy their first home. Wages, earning power have not even come close to keeping pace. I'm speaking today for one of the largest groups of people in Oregon, the working stiff, the citizens that are paying state taxes, the family that isn't eligible for any type of state aid. After all, both parents are working. Yet they are unable to afford their own home. In Oregon, of all places where we pride the quality of life, this group is getting larger, more frustrated, and angry. This tax credit concept would provide a new source of dollars from corporations and employers to assist this workforce in fulfilling a dream of home ownership. I would request that you give it more than a quick look and a turn down. Please push it forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gale.
Representative Butler, members of the House Committee, for the record, my name is John Gale. I am the Homeownership Program Manager for Oregon Housing and Community Services. Our director, Bob Repine, who I know has been before you many times, was unable to be here today, but he has asked me to address House Bill 3378. This bill encourages employers to assist their hardworking employees by providing home purchase assistance in the form of down payment and closing cost assistance to buy a home. And in my position as the homeownership program manager, I frequently hear from hardworking Oregonians who are struggling to afford a home of their own and who cannot even afford to purchase a decent home. A buyer will typically need anywhere from 3 to 6% in terms of closing costs and down payment, and even on a $150,000 house, which is hard to find in some spots, that's going to be $4,500 to $9,000 in cash that they need to come up with. A survey done up in Washington by the Community Home Ownership Center is a nonprofit-based organization. They surveyed 12,000 first-time homebuyers up there. 79% of those that responded cited having enough cash to close as being a primary barrier to getting into their first home. Source is emerging trends for first-time homebuyers in Washington State. Certainly happy to provide that if you like. While there are down payment assistance programs for many people, they're typically limited to low-income first-time homebuyers. And so there is a gap between those that are low-income and those that are might just be above that limit that don't have any forms of assistance available to them. So this resource would be a whole new resource that could be bring new resources to the table to help deal with this disparity. Yes, there are a few employers who are already doing this. Some examples are Rejuvenation Hardware, Manual Hospital, Valker Siltronic, and University of Portland. There's others as well. It's a short list, but these employers understand that employer homeownership assistance programs are in their best interest as well as the best interest of their employees. Employees who buy a home of their own are rewarded by giving their employer greater loyalty, increased productivity, and reduced turnover. And since these homeowners are more vested, as Mr. Anderson has said, they're more likely to be less mobile, more likely to be there to continue doing the job that they need to be done. House Bill 3378 will enable employers who provide home purchase assistance to their employees to be reimbursed by an Oregon tax credit. The passage of this bill will reward those employers, those community-minded employers, for going the extra mile and on behalf of their employees, and at the same time lower their recruitment and turnover costs and increase employee productivity. We are also seeing a lot of employers who are interested in as a benefit to their employees, providing some homeownership assistance, and this can also be a great recruitment strategy as well. So thank you for allowing me to address you this afternoon. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Anderson or Mr. Gale, Representative Galizio?
Good afternoon. What barrier or barriers exist in the status quo that prevents employers from paying people more money in salary and wages so that they could have the money instead of being subsidized by taxpayers?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the marketplace is simply the answer. Will their products, you know, generate revenue where they can pay higher wages? So, I mean, we can go around and around, and I'm certainly for it. I, too, would like a raise. So if that's what you're asking, please send my employer a notice. But there's a direct relationship with what can I afford to work. What we're finding is that the home, by putting the workforce in the home, the employer can perhaps get them closer to the plant and cutting down on commute and absenteeism. Why they haven't done it to date. We're also in a high unemployment environment right now. So this it could be just enough of an incentive for employers to look at doing something extra. Again, going back to, if you believe homeownership brings additional value to the community, then this is a good thing.
Your answer is the market. So what are the factors, or what's the structure that leads to the cost of the high cost of housing? Is it also the market?
Supply and, Mr. Chairman, Representative, supply and demand, certainly both sides of the equation, availability of housing stock and then the demand for that housing stock. After all, we're an in-growth state, a lot of demand, not building as much. There's a low inventory of housing stock now. But I think, if I could, the point really is that there's a big gap between what the workforce can afford and the price, the median price. Just take medium income, medium sales price, and a 3% down payment program doesn't pack it. What my vision of this employer-assisted housing is something more substantial. If some of these employers that John talked about, you know, put up $5,000 to $10,000 as a second mortgage to their employee as a buy down to help what they can afford to pay in debt versus the sales price. And then if they stay, typically it's a forgiving clause, so that soft second goes away. This fund money would normally, or on lower income, comes from the government or, you know, some kind of public sector. We're just suggesting using the same kind of concepts, but go to the workforce who granted would benefit. It doesn't necessarily have to be a dollar for dollar tax credit. I don't know if I've answered your question.
Is that responsive, Representative Galizio?
Yes, thank you.
Representative Esquivel?
Yes, I think I can help a little bit about on the rising costs of homes, and I live in a community that has a very economically challenged area, that is Medford, and this last month the average house in West Medford, which is the economically challenged area of the city, was $232,000. Now, what is happening here in the market is there is a supply and demand, but more importantly, the representative talked about some land use, and there are some land use issues. There's also the interest rates are what's accelerating value today. The third thing is people that come to our fair state to retire. There's a different set of economics where they come from. The other thing is, what's very interesting is you take the city of Salem, you take the city of Medford. We just ran on a computer to find out how many homes in the city of Medford in that area were under 150,000. We found 9. We did the same thing in Salem and found 276. So the geographical area, and why is that? Because people go to Medford to retire. And our population has grown 3% per year religiously for 20 years, and yet our population in our schools are declining. Now, my concern is this. We have programs that allow $15,000 toward people for a down payment and closing costs. But the problem is they're low income. They end up not qualifying for the loans, so this money sits around not being used. So we have some real, real serious challenges coming up here in the future, because I have yet to see the market slide backward. So my concern is, when do we price people out to where they can't afford to live in the community they grew up in? That's my real concern.
Thank you, Representative. And I understand this is a business tax credit that would be available for employers to advance to their employees, and that probably wouldn't be an issue at retirement at that particular point, unless you were self-employed in Representative Riley's business, where he'll go ahead and provide himself that opportunity to do that, advance it to himself and take the credit. Representative Riley, did you have a question?
I did. I'm all in favor of homeownership, and I'm in favor of employers helping their employees buy homes. What bothers me is having the employers choose which people in the state we decide to help. And that's why I call the employer the middleman, and making the decision about who gets the money. And that's my only problem with this bill is that someone is making a choice from their employees, not from the general population, of who gets it. My employee, who do I like best in my staff? Yeah, that's kind of how I see this, and that bothers me some.
Mr. Chairman, I share that concern. I can tell you what has gone before us with employers, and I think earlier there was a question which is a big concern of mine, of it just turning into what already exists, a management relocation program. I think an easy amendment of putting an income limit in the bill would do it, and I would suggest 120% of median income is a good lid, because now you're looking at the working core, and over 120, what we're finding, except for Medford, they're able to now afford at least a reasonable medium-priced home. Under 120 to 80%, they're in no man's land. Under 80% median income, they're now eligible for aid and stuff. So it's that 80 to 120%. To get to the target, it's typically been a first-come, first-serve. It's the way companies have done it. Anthro Corporation in Tigard is a good manufacturing company in Tigard. They have just religiously said, we will support 4 to 5 employees a year. First-come, first-serve. That's how they do it. And now they do have a lid on income and that kind of stuff. But that kind of stuff could be put in, but at some point it is a first come, first serve.
And it sounds like that company, they are probably advancing it, like Representative Galizio had indicated, probably advancing it in the form of wages, which flows through a W-2 at that point.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, when it's forgiven, because it starts out as a loan, typically the way they've structured it, as a loan with interest and due on sale of the house, so no payments. But it accumulates. Then there's typically a clause that says, for every year you stay with us, we'll forgive. Now, that forgivable piece is tax
income.
You bet.
And that would respond to Representative Galizio's concern. Representative Cohn.
The question is for Elizabeth. Thank you, Chairman Butler. Elizabeth, the way this is currently written, and don't accuse me for starting to think like our honored chairperson, but if I am an employer in, let's say, Portland, which, you know, Washington's just on the other side of the river, so I can help my employee buy a home in another state?
Representative, that's right. I don't see any requirement that the purchase of the home has to be in the state of Oregon. You know, and actually, when I read it, I don't even see where they have to live in the home. It could be a rental property,
right,
because there's no restriction. It just has to, they have to purchase a home. It doesn't say they have to purchase a home and live in it, have to be their principal abode. So.
Yeah, because I just want to be on the record. I'm for all kinds of economic growth in Oregon, but I'd like to keep it somewhat in Oregon.
Excellent point, Jenny. Thank you very much. No further questions. We appreciate you being here, and we'll go ahead. Then that's all I had signed up on House Bill 3378, and so we will close the hearing, public hearing on House Bill 3378, and we have Representative Burley. Yes, Representative Burley is here on House Bill 2729, so we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2729.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and with your permission, I'd like to invite two gentlemen up with me.
Okay,
Mr. Shelton and Mr. Buckman.
Well, we haven't heard this bill before. Why don't we have Maz go ahead and give us the some information about this bill first?
Chair Butler, members of the committee, Maz and Maddox, Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 2729 is a new bill, introduces new sections of law in Oregon Revised Statutes. It basically allows for a creation of what is defined in the bill as the Community Forest Authority. And this new entity is primarily created, and the process of the creation and founding of this new entities in the bill were a request either by three individuals or the municipality, and it leaves the door open. Municipality, to either being city or county, need to issue an ordinance or a resolution if it's a county to establish this and new authority, and it goes in details of the board of directors, number of that board, and how it is divided, and it tries, I think, to maintain certain balance between conservation advocates and industry, as well as the public, while maintaining one of these directors as one of the officers of the municipality. Now, the main job that seems the to concern the authority is to be able to issue a tax-exempt revenue bonds, where it could use those in order to buy or purchase or manage forest land and use the revenue coming from managing of those forest land into paying back those bonds. And it seems like once there is no bonds to take care of, the authority for the existence of the Forest Authority ceases to continue. However, it does not have the authority to levy taxes, and it will still, these bonds are not considered to be general obligation bonds on the municipality that the authority will exist within, although if that authority has extra or excess funds at the time after the payments of the bonds, those amounts of money would revert back to either the city or the county. And in that sense, it is a municipal corporation that is able to issue those tax-exempt bonds. At this time, Mr. Chair, it's really not easy to, or have not been able to find out, or it's not clear how many cities, if you say, or counties, would take advantage of this new municipal corporation, how much land we are talking about, how much in bonds that needs to be sold, raised, or issued in order to accomplish the intent of the bill, and I suspect we will be learning more about this as we go.
Thank you, Mayor. Representative Burley, welcome. Welcome you to our committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Thank you very much.
I am Representative Chuck Burley, House District 54. It's a pleasure to be here again for this committee, and I want to apologize to Representatives Boquist and Hass. They've already heard this once on Ag and Natural Resources Committee. As you know, the forest products industry has undergone some significant changes in the past 15 years or more here in the state of Oregon. A lot of this is attributable to federal forest policies. But as a result, in the past few years, we've seen two of the largest industrial forest landowners in eastern Oregon change hands, leaving the future of large blocks of working forest lands in question. In a report last year titled Land Use Change on Non-Federal Land in Eastern Oregon, published by the Department of Forestry, there were some statistics in there that really jumped out at me. Since 1975 in Central Oregon, the area of low-density residential use has increased by 86% and the urban area by 137%. And the highest rates of change in dominant land use over the past 26 years has occurred in Central Oregon and Klamath County, and much of that is coming out of agriculture, range, forest land, and the mixes thereof into these low-density residential and urban-type uses. Recently, and Mr. Schelk here at my left will elaborate on this, we've seen several large blocks of industrial forest land bought by private interests and, for all intents and purposes, taken out of a working forest scenario. They buy them. They're private party transactions, which are fine. Nobody's arguing that. But the fact is there are large blocks, 30,000, 40,000-acre blocks of land that are being taken out of production because they're being bought for other purposes. So make no mistake about it, I would prefer that these blocks of lands remain in private industrial ownership, but because of the higher and better values of some of them, I think the future's in question. So Mr. Tuckman to my far left and Mr. Schelk are going to go through this in more detail, but there's a few points that I just want to make up front about this. This bill does not mandate anybody to do anything. Okay. It's just putting a tool in the toolbox out there if communities want to try and pursue this. Secondly, this bill does not result in any more public land ownership. No public lands are being bought here. These lands are not being converted from private to public ownership. This bill does provide an opportunity for local ownership and local control. And the concept of this bill is that the lands would have to remain as a working forest to provide commodity products as well as the resource values we all prize, such as fish and wildlife, habitat, clean water, clean air, and public use. But the key here is that a working forest provides commodity products, and these lands would have to be managed to produce the revenue to pay off, as your committee administrator said, the revenue bonds, not GO bonds, but revenue bonds. This whole model is, the concept is modeled after the Hospital Financing Authority, which is already in the Oregon Revised Statutes, Chapter 441, Sections 525 through 595. So what it's doing is it's taking an existing model that has worked before, and it's just applying it to a different concept. Instead of a community building a hospital for public purpose, it's going to acquire and manage large blocks of forest land for a public purpose. Also, I want to make clear, this bill is not intended to solve the industry's problems. You know, there's a lot of other things out there from federal land policies and other issues that we can deal with. But it's just another tool to try and help keep some of these large blocks of working forest in a working forest condition. It doesn't undermine any private party transaction. If a timber company wants to come and buy them, fine, great. That's all just as well and good. So anyways, with that, Mr. Chair, too, I'd like to point out that since the last, when Ag and Natural Resources had the hearing on this in work session and passed this bill out unanimously, we have had quite a few more conversations with folks.
And there's two things that we're looking at possibly amending in here. One is to just further emphasize and make it absolutely clear that we're talking about commercial forest lands to be acquired and to be maintained and managed in that sense. And also that, and Mr. Tuckman, I think, could probably explain this further, but the Forest Authority itself, the Municipal Corporation, I believe, is what it's referred to in technical terms. We're thinking about amending the language to prohibit that particular body from actually acquiring and owning the lands. Instead, that they would issue the revenue bonds on behalf of either an instrumentality or a private nonprofit organization, which the bill already allows for anyways. Any one of those three could acquire the lands. And we'll explain that a little bit later. But those are a couple of things we're looking at possibly amending right now.
So, Representative, just to make sure, does this bill presently deal only with forest lands and some definition of forest lands, forested lands?
Yes.
When you talk about it not adding any additional lands to the governmental bodies, you're talking about acquiring federal forest lands then?
But the concern that some people, when we have visited with folks about this bill, the concern that some people have had is that it's a way for a county to buy lands. You know, so now you've got more public lands at the county level, buying private forest lands, and then they become public. And, of course, the question there and the concern, which is a very valid one, is, you know, to what degree are they then subject to ballot initiatives and other types of things that we've seen vis-a-vis a private ownership? Now, you know, even private forest lands, as some folks on the committee can attest to, are never 100% immune from lawsuits or even ballot measures, for that matter. I mean, we saw a ballot measure, what was it, 66, I think, that tried to ban clear-cutting on all ownerships in the state of Oregon years ago. But this bill, either whether it's through an instrumentality or a private nonprofit, that is still privately owned. So it's got the same protections, if you will, and the same regulations as any other privately owned commercial forest land would have as far as Forest Practices Act, water quality, and all those other types of regulations. But it would not be publicly owned.
Okay. Let's see. Is it next, Mr. Tuckman?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Tom Tuckman. I'm president of U.S. Forest Capital. We're a small forestry and financial services company, and we work with both existing landowners and folks that want to be landowners on a wide variety of financing and environmental issues that they face in day-to-day operations. Very much appreciate your leadership in holding this hearing today, and I, too, would like to say some of my comments are going to be repetitive. Representative Haas and Representative Berger have heard this a couple years ago when we first were talking about this bill. The hearing or the statement I submitted for the record goes into some detail, and Representative Burley did a great job of explaining what we're doing. And let me just add a couple points to that. I'd also like to introduce Doug Goh, who's accompanying me from Orrick Harrington. And Mr. Goh helped us put this legislation together, and I think you know he's very knowledgeable on these matters throughout the state. What is the problem? Representative Burley did a great job talking specifically about Oregon. When I was here a couple years ago, we were talking at the time about changes, potential changes in Oregon. He mentioned it. Actually, in eastern Oregon, all four major ownerships changed hands in the last 18 months. And that's being driven. There are issues related to federal timber supply and environmental regulations, but it's also related to macroeconomic issues in the industry and conditions in the industry. I thought this was an amazing statistic. 50% of the industrial timberland in this country has changed hands in the last 10 years. 50%. And the reason for that is that traditional companies that own forests as supply for their mills are now looking at it as an independent asset class and selling off those properties that are non-core to monetize their asset, and they redeploy that all over the world. And I don't that's not bad, it's not good, it's a fact, and it's changing the face of forest ownership in this country. And what that leads to is folks that come in to maximize their net present value, which, again, is they have every right to do, but it changes the forest practices, and it leads to more fragmentation to do that. So what we've done, and I have a bias it's as a forester and wanting to maintain working forest lands, is work with members of the forest products community, local communities, conservation community, and said, is there a capital market tool, not a public financing tool, but a capital market tool that can help maintain the economic efficiency of working forest lands in this country? And what we've come up with is what we call community forestry bonds. The issue or the concept is relatively easy, but there are a lot of details on it. You provided a good outline. What we do is work with communities. We put together a qualified organization that can have access to either taxable or tax-exempt debt. I want to make that clear. It's not just tax-exempt debt, but they would also be able to use proceeds from taxable municipal debt. And they do a pure third-party willing seller, willing buyer negotiation, agree on price. And the authority we're looking for is for that entity to be able to go to a forest authority. An entity created by a municipality that is created for the specific purposes of issuing debt for this forest land acquisition. And getting back, Chair Butler, to your question, this would be for forestry, and it's defined in the bill. Okay. After the debt is issued, the debt would be paid back through timber harvest, through a management plan put together by that private nonprofit. After the debt has been paid, and this is referring to the amendment that Representative Burley talked about, we would like to have some changes made to the bill to make sure that that land is retained in working forest land, commercial forest land, in the future, assuming markets are there. And what it really does is bring together a capital market source with a governance source that will maintain working forest lands. And as you all know, forestry, not just in Oregon but throughout many parts of this country, can be controversial. As one federal representative said, everybody in my district loves trees. The only problem is half of them like them standing up and the other half laying down. And I think there's a simplification, but there's some truth to that. And so we're trying to figure out a way to get some folks together to figure out how many are standing up and laying down in a way that helps provide jobs and sustains local communities and the environment. With that, I'll turn to Mr. Shelk.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, I'm John Shelk from Ochoco Lumber Company in Prineville. Our company has been in existence in Prineville since 1924, owning timberland and operating sawmills. I met Tom a number of years ago when he worked for the federal government, and more recently, several years ago, we renewed our acquaintance relative to this particular issue. There's some immediacy to what we're talking about here. Both Mr. Tuckman and Representative Burley have mentioned that there's a lot of timberland in eastern Oregon that has changed hands in the last 5 years. There's currently over 500,000 acres that's in play right now, private timberland. There's one parcel of land that's just to the west of Bend. It's actually just abutting Bend's urban growth boundary. This is timberland that's been harvested recently. It was originally owned by Brooks Scanlon Corporation, and through various iterations moved down until it was owned by a company that that chose to harvest it very heavily. And this land is now owned by people holding debt that have no particular interest in this timberland being anything other than something that's going to yield them the highest return on their particular debt. It's 31,000 acres called the Bull Springs Tree Farm, just west of Bend. At this point, it's not in a state that you would be able to begin normal timber harvest. It is frankly being nibbled at from the edges by land developers. timberland in eastern Oregon because of its low growth characteristics, sometimes less than 20% of here in western Oregon, is going for prices as low as $300 an acre. Any of you that are involved with development or no land values, obviously $300 an acre would be a steal for residential development. So here's the real difference is that someone could pick this land up at a relatively reasonable value, develop the land. That takes away the opportunity for forestry. It also takes away the opportunity, and keep in mind that this is within about 10 to 12 miles of Bend generally, for wildlife. This is a mid to higher elevation deer wintering range. There are a variety of wildlife that winter out there. Deer don't winter very well when they have to share their property with their land with llamas. And characteristically, that's what happens in properties like this. The forest industry east of the Cascades has suffered some huge losses, primarily due to federal land management policies. If this industry is to recover and sustain itself, it needs its private timber base as well as its federal timber base. That must be in existence. If we don't have something that allows some of these currently over-harvested and lower-value lands to be acquired by someone that has something other than an immediate profit motive in mind, then there's a strong likelihood that we're going to lose even more timber base and timber industry east of the Cascades. And we just can't afford to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil.
Chair Butler, members of the committee, I'm Doug Goh with Warwick Harrington and Sutcliffe in Portland, and I'm primarily here to answer any technical questions that you may have about the bonding aspects of the bill, but I just wanted to emphasize a couple points that have already been made by Representative Burley and Mr. Tuckman. And that is, first of all, in terms of the kind of the model for this entity is hospital authorities, which have been around in Oregon since the early 1970s and were created for the same sort of purpose, and that is to allow our nonprofit hospitals around the state to be able to take advantage of the capital markets and tax-exempt financing in particular. The sole responsibility for the repayment of the bonds under this bill, and likewise with hospital authorities, is whoever the nonprofit corporation is that comes to the authority and asks it to issue revenue bonds based solely on the credit of not the authority, but the nonprofit borrower. And so, as was pointed out by committee staff, these are not general obligation bonds. The creating municipality has no legal liability with respect to them. The authority itself would not have any assets. Its sole purpose is to create a financing vehicle that can help address this issue. Representative Escobal has had experience with hospital authorities, and I think that they've been a good model, and I think can be a very good model in addressing this timber issue that Mr. Shelk and Mr. Tuckman and Representative Burley have presented to the committee. Be happy to address any questions the committee may have.
Thank you. Questions, members of the committee. Doug, I have one question relative to the authority. This is granting cities and counties similar authority to what hospital districts have. They don't have the authority to issue some kind of bond that would be I guess this is really a kind of a certificate of participation bond is what it would be. They don't have that authority at present?
That is correct. Are you in the context of the Forest Authority or the Hospital Authority?
In the context of the Forest Authority.
In the context of the Forest Authority, they would not have that. They would have the authority, for example, a city or county, if it wanted to finance forest lands for public land purposes, they could issue bonds for that purpose, either revenue bonds or general obligation bonds. However, they would not have the authority under current law to loan the proceeds on a conduit financing basis to a nonprofit corporation. It would have to be for their own, the city or county's own purposes. And again, this bill is addressed at not public lands, but at private forest lands. Is that responsive to the question, Mr. Chairman?
That is responsive. So what we're saying is that if the city or county goes to purchase these lands to make them public for public purposes, could it lease these land? It could then use their bonding authority. Could it then lease that property to the nonprofit organization for the intended purpose at that point?
Chair Butler, members of the committee, the purpose under existing law, the answer would be yes. They if a county, let's say Deschutes County, for example, wanted to issue its own bonds, general obligation or revenue bonds, and then in turn lease those, issue bonds, acquire those lands, and then lease those to private business, it could do that. But that is really not, again, what this bill is aimed at. What this bill is aimed at is solely having that city or county, if it so chooses, create a separate public authority called a municipal forest authority, a community forest authority, to issue bonds on behalf of this private nonprofit corporation whose sole purpose would be to keep these private commercial forest lands in play.
So this is some authority that they don't presently
have? That is authority that they do not currently have, absolutely.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, it's been a couple of years. And so remind me. It seemed to me that one of the issues around this that was brought up was they purchased this and then it is tax exempt. There is no taxation, local taxation on the plan?
Based on suggestions from the committee, which we agreed with, we incorporated, last session we had amendments. In Representative Burley's bill, we incorporated those amendments into the legislation as introduced to do two things that were brought up last session. One was make sure that property taxes are paid. So this nonprofit entity would be required to pay property taxes. And number two, there was also an issue, I'm jumping ahead here, also an issue of whether a county could buy land in another county, and that is prohibited unless the other, if you will, the county is invited into that county.
Thank you, gentlemen. I remember those issues from last, and so you anticipated.
Yes.
However, I will say in Section 13, they are tax exempt, but where in this bill does it say that property taxes will be paid?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, the tax exemption for real property taxes in the bill is page 5, line 37. That's where it says that they could pay the property taxes subject to taxation if owned by or leased by the property. And then it specifies the special districts. You remember that from last session, the special districts of the fire districts, small districts, basically. Those are the ones who maintain imposing the taxes. The rest, it seems from the language, the rest of the property taxes would be open for discussion unless this property is being leased to an organization that does not have a tax exemption status. Then it would be paying. However, there is also an open question: is if after this entity dissolves, suppose that it doesn't have any more bonds, the law says if it doesn't have any more bonds to worry about, then it dissolves. If it dissolves and it had already issued bond and acquired land, who owns the land? By definition, because in the bottom of the bill it says all assets go back to the initiating municipality, you would assume that all the lands would go back to either the city or the county.
Mr. Chairman, if I may respond to that last question.
Tom?
Representative Burley, at the end of his testimony, identified two areas where he would like further clarification. This issue is one of them. We wanted to clarify in the legislation that, number one, this debt would be issued only for nonprofit purposes, and the Forest Authority itself would be the, if you will, conduit or issuing authority, and that nonprofit, after the debt is paid off, would be the landowner, if you will, in perpetuity. So that nonprofit landowner would finance the acquisition through the issuance of tax or tax-exempt debt. Debt is paid off. They would continue to maintain those commercial working forest lands for commercial working forest purposes.
Tell me about. And I'm Doug, you're an attorney. What is a nonprofit corporation that's only owning lands that are going to timber those lands and hold them for the timber? Tell me what the nonprofit purpose of that corporation is.
Chair Butler, members of the committee, I think that the purpose of the in terms of the specific scope will be determined by that particular articles of incorporation of that nonprofit corporation. But I think implicit in your question is, in terms of its core purpose, will be in fact to keep the lands in private commercial forest industry, and that's the nonprofit nature of it. There is also, in terms of Mr. Tuckman may want to address any kind of conservation related issues associated with that.
But wouldn't the nonprofit entity at that point have unrelated business income to the extent that it has operated this forest?
In terms of the nonprofit, I think the answer very well may be yes. Again, remember, in terms of nonprofits, this, when we refer to a nonprofit corporation, is referring to a state a corporation organized under the State Nonprofit Corporation Act.
A municipal corporation?
No. A corporation organized in the Nonprofit Corporation Act of the State of Oregon. It also very well may be a 501c3. It also may be a 501c3 organization qualifying under Section 501c3 of the Internal Revenue Code, in which case that nonprofit corporation, if it was so organized, it may have unrelated business income. However, if in fact its purpose is the provision of keeping lands in the and I'm not the tax lawyer, I have plenty of partners who are, but my understanding is that if the purpose is keeping forest lands in production, it in fact would not be unrelated business income, because it in fact would be related to its nonprofit purpose.
Okay, other questions, members of the committee? Thank you very much, gentlemen. We have, four more here. Bill Cluding, Western Council of Industry of Workers in Polk County, Ted Lawrenson, Gil Riddell,
Chair Butler, committee. I'm Bill Cluding, representing over 4,000 members of the Western Council of Industrial Workers in Oregon. We used to have many times that number. My members need a steady supply of timber from our timberlands. In order to accomplish this, we need a stable timber-producing land base. House Bill 2729 is a bill that would help maintain this timber land base. It would assure that with a willing seller, and a willing qualified private buyer could purchase such lands. These lands would be managed for sustainable timber production. Harvest income would go to pay off debts, however incurred with a land purchase. House Bill 2729 would promote community stability and sound conservation practices. All activities of said lands would follow the Oregon Forest Practices Act. Chair Butler, if I may again, I have 8 pages of mill closures since 1989, totaling tens and tens of thousands of Oregon jobs. Studies show that one timber job lost is 2 secondary jobs. Our neighboring state to the north, as we speak, is building new mills. They are doubling capacity in several other mills. With the uncertain effects of Measure 37, sir, Oregon could very easily lose more valuable timber lands. Chair Butler and committee, my members and all timber-related workers in Oregon would be helped by the passage of House Bill 2729.
Thank you, Mr. Cleeding. Mr. Lawrenson?
Okay. Chair Butler, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ted Lawrence, an assistant state forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry. The department is already on record in support of this bill in front of the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee, and we remain committed to working with the bill sponsors to address the issues that they've raised today. My written testimony, I talk about the economic value of Oregon's forests, maintaining the working forest land base. In the context of my prejudices in terms of this issue, I wanted to be clear about them. The Board of Forestry has adopted what they call the Forestry Program for Oregon, and it really has 7 key strategies, 2 of which get to maintaining a forest land base and then its productive capacity. And those 2 need to work hand-in-hand to produce the range of economic and other benefits from these kind of forests. There are also a number of other benefits that have been discussed, but particularly in some of the distressed eastern Oregon forest lands around Bend, Klamath County, there are substantial wildfire and forest health issues that, again, conversion of these lands to other uses, failure to maintain an economic viability can impact those sorts of factors significantly and raise costs for all of Oregonians in any number of ways. In the context of jobs, though, I think a number of folks raised some of the factors for why we have some distressed forest lands. In the context of harvest, 1 million board feet per year will produce about 16 permanent jobs and an annual income tax revenue of about $68,000. In terms of an acre, about 600 board feet can be reduced per acre on average out of a well-managed productive timberland, and thus about 1,700 acres can support about the 1 million board feet that provide those 16 jobs and $68,000 of tax revenue.
John Schilk talked about the scope of the land west of Bend, 30,000, 40,000 acres. Again, that's a fairly significant number of jobs that can be maintained by securing this land base as a permanent timberland production output process. So with that, we do support this bill. I think it's an important tool, and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lawrence. And Mr. Riddell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. As you well know, ALC has a widely diverse membership. Some of the commissioners are very excited about this bill. They see it as a tool to save the eroding forest land base. Other commissioners have expressed suspicion because of fear of further set-asides from production. The way the commissioners resolved their disagreement was to say that the bill as written, they would oppose the bill as written but would support the bill with amendments making it clear that any forest land acquired under this program would be done so for commercial purposes. And I heard the proponents earlier and I've talked to them earlier, and they're very much in agreement with that. So, in effect, if that happens, then we will support the bill.
And, Gil, you're working with the proponents of the bill to address those issues?
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions of this panel? Thank you very much. You'll get some amendments to us. And Ray Wilkinson. And Greg Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ray Wilkinson, Oregon Forest Industries Council. We represent private forest landowners in Oregon. I'd first like to acknowledge the hard work that the several people put into this bill. Representative Burley, as I think most of you know, has worked for the forest industry for many years before he became a legislator. John Schilk, who you heard from, is a charter member. His company's a charter member of OFIC, longstanding member of our board, and a longstanding member of the Oregon State Board of Forestry, and someone who has enormous respect from his peers in the timber industry across the state. I'd also like to acknowledge Mr. Tuckman's willingness. This bill, a very similar bill, was before this committee 2 years ago, passed out of the committee. It was introduced late, so it didn't pass, but Mr. Tuckman mentioned a couple issues that we raised that he's been willing to adjust related to taxes and cross-county lines and that sort of thing. Our members are, like the counties, are a little bit conflicted on this. There are some people who see ghosts and goblins here that might be a negative. From a 50,000-foot view, however, the concept of this is absolutely essential. In order to maintain a strong forest products industry in the state, you've got to have a raw material base. You've got to have the forest land to grow the trees to provide the material to maintain the industry. And there is evidence of erosion of that base in this state. It's particularly acute in eastern Oregon, but there's similar pressures we're seeing in western Oregon as well. So this bill, as you've heard, would allow a county, not require a county or a municipality, to take a step that they can't legally take now, apparently, to try to reverse the erosion of that resource base and try to maintain a rural resource-based economy in their area. So from that perspective, this is a great idea. As we get closer to it and drill down a little bit, some of our members are concerned about some of the things you've heard already. This is kind of a hybrid, quasi-public-private sort of a thing, and so there are concerns about more land being moved out of purely private hands into something that looks like a public ownership. So some people have that concern. There's some concern about competition from others, private entities who want to buy forest land, if this would be a competition that has an advantage that they wouldn't have. And then there's some concern about the effectiveness in eastern Oregon, mostly federal land over there. Even if you had the private forest land totally in 100% production, could you maintain an industry when the federal lands are shut down? So those are the kinds of things some of our members have expressed. We don't have an official position. We have a small executive committee, 5 members. They'd like to see the bill limited to eastern Oregon, but we have other members, Mr. Schilk being one, obviously, but there are several others that would not want that kind of a limitation. So with that, I wish I could be more definitive, but I think I would end where I started by acknowledging the hard work that people like Chuck Burley and Representative Burley and John Schilk have put into this for a number of years, and I think it's worthy of your consideration. So thank you.
Ray, you've used one word that I'm anxious about, and that is this is an authority that you apparently do not have. You're wondering if they do have this authority.
I assume they do not, Mr. Chairman. Or I mean, their previous witnesses are the experts on this, and I'm
anxious that they may have the authority to do it, but I'm not sure what happens when they bring in the nonprofits to lend their bonding authority. So it's something that I'd have to be a little more convinced of personally.
Right, Mr. Chairman, and maybe that's through some of the amendment language they're talking about working on. Maybe that can be cleared up.
Okay, thank you. And, Greg, I apologize for missing you. You've written your name in, and it was very small, and I didn't know whether that was a subsidiary or just what. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name's Greg Miller, Government Affairs Manager for Weyerhaeuser Company. In the interest of time, I'll keep my remarks very brief, and it was Ray's fault that you couldn't read the handwriting. So I'm a subsidiary of OFIC. Just for the record also, we have 1.1 million acres of forest land ownership in the state of Oregon. That's the paid commercial. It's all in western Oregon. And we support the concept for creating this community forest authority and hope that the House Revenue Committee decides to pass this bill to the floor. And you've heard some of the very basics of the large block forest land ownership discussion about the changes that are going on, and you've also heard about the fundamental aspect of keeping the Oregon's forest sector as viable as possible with sustainable harvest off of private forest land. What you haven't heard, but I think some of you may be aware of it, is just a pretty startling statistic as to why this particular alternative financial mechanism can be helpful as a tool in the toolbox. And we have gone from a historical harvest level, annual harvest level in this state, from 8 billion board feet to 4 billion board feet. I have that number burned in my mind because that is a pretty stark statistic that points to the dependence on private, industrial, non-industrial, and some state forest land harvest for our traded sector, the forest sector that we have today in the state. It's competitive, it's viable, and we need to try and keep our large block forest land ownerships in that capacity as well. We have a very active forest land acquisition and disposition program. We look at our forest land ownership in a very strategic way and how they fit our processing facilities to maximize our value for operations. And so this is just another financial instrument relative to an organization like Weyerhaeuser that is also a timberland seller and buyer. And as a seller, we like to see a lot of buyers at the table. So with that, I close my remarks and answer any questions.
Thank you, Greg. Questions of either Ray Wilkinson or Greg Miller? Thank you again.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here. And if you'll work with the counties and the other affected parties, Ray and Greg, I would appreciate it. And then work with Legislative Revenue Office with the amendments so that the questions that have been brought forward can be answered.
Thank you.
Thank you again. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2729. The hour is drawing late. We've got some work sessions scheduled here. Are the folks here on House Bills 3453 and 3454? How about on 2950, 2951? I received a message earlier that there were people that would have to be called back and forth. Tamara, I see you here. 3453 and 3454, are those folks all here? Okay. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3453. This is a work session, and we'll follow that with 3454. We've got those folks right here handy.
Thirty-four fifty-three.
The work session, Mary.
Mm-hmm. House Bill 3453 will exempt from property tax any tangible or intangible property whose use arises between qualified governmental entities and energy marketing companies. A qualified governmental entity is a public body defined by the statute ORS 174.109, which is state governmental bodies, local governmental bodies, and special governmental bodies. It applies to tax years beginning on or after July 1, 2006. As background, I can tell you that House, the House bill was initiated by Pacific Power Marketing, PPM, because of a tax court decision that is currently under appeal. In this case, PPM versus the Department of Revenue, the tax court ruled in the department's favor with respect to a property tax assessment of roughly $9 million for tax year 2002. The assessment was based on the DOR's position that PPM's use of tangible or intangible real or personal property owned by a qualified governmental entity was subject to tax. The tax court ruled that the contracts between PPM and the governmental entity had a value that represented the intangible property that was subject to property tax under current law, irrespective of whether the contracts conveyed a possessory interest in the property.
Now, that was $0.9 million, is
correct.
That right?
Correct.
Thank you. Okay.
Under current law, centrally assessed property can be both tangible and intangible property, but governmentally owned property is exempt from property tax. When the City of Klamath Falls contract with PPM transferred rights to PPM to use its property, the city's property tax exemption was not transferable to PPM. House Bill 3453 will confer this exemption to PPM and other qualified energy marketing companies that have contracts with qualified governmental entities. There are several, since our initial public hearing on this, I tried to do some research on this and spoke to several entities, one of which was a manager for the Eugene Water and Electric Board, who could cite for me several electric generating plants that are city-owned. However, they're very small, and the largest one, of course, which is very large, Eugene Water and Electric Board, EWEB, is the largest public utility in Oregon. It does not currently have a contract, nor does it plan to have a contract with an energy marketing company. Based on this background information, we've received testimony previously about the agreements between, about the agreements from the Oregon Association of County, and they presented their views that this establishes a new public policy with respect to future public-private agreements, and that the taxes should be collected. Testimony was always also provided by advocates of the bill, indicating that the contract between PPM and the City of Klamath Falls is unique in Oregon, which limits the current revenue impact of the House bill. The committee asked if there were any electric generating plants in Oregon that are owned by governmental entities, and as I just mentioned, there are several, but they're very small with the exception of EWEB. Therefore, I haven't assigned any large impact to this bill. However, I do want to mention that the contracts are not that may exist today that only include or pertain to one company do not necessarily mean that in the future contracts between other city-owned, small, if you will, companies couldn't be, you know, initiated.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Questions of staff? Is it in the record that had the parties anticipated and known that the Department of Revenue was going to be assessing this intangible contract, is it in the record that they could have elected to go ahead and be part of the economic development to the enterprise zone? Did we get that in the record previously?
No.
Okay. Mr. Chair, that testimony was given.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Excellent. Thank you very much. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3453 to the House with a due pass recommendation.
You've heard the motion. Discussion on the motion. Representative.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr.
Boquist.
Chair.
Representative Boquist, please.
It's late in the day, Mr.
Chair.
Wasn't
expecting.
I'm going to take a couple of minutes because the same issues I have are going to pertain to the second one, and I'll just say ghetto afterwards. In both these issues, we have discussions of intangible property. And I think that regardless of what the committee does in these actions, the issue of intangible property is still going to be sitting before us. I think if nothing else in the interim, we need to address this, because what we're really doing here is pitting citizen versus citizen, city against county, district against district. And so there's some serious challenges. And my research of this, which I don't want to bring up in committee, shows that it's a Pandora's box. So while we may be fixing an issue right here, we're putting a Band-Aid on a sucking chest wound. And I fear that there will be more effort made and more tax dollars expended to find more sources of revenue from government entities. And we're really trying to tax government entities here, and I think it's bad public policy. So I just want to be on record that, you know, I'm a yes vote, probably both of them, no doubt, but I think this issue is not going away, and the downrange impact of this has got to be addressed by this committee.
We're still working on the second test one here. Right?
Compression.
Our Representative Olson jump over that one. Further discussion? The motion is to move House Bill 3453 to the House with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Representative Berger, want to carry that?
Not particularly, but I will.
Fine, thank you. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 3453, and we will open a work session on House Bill 3454. All
right. Sucking chest wounds are hard to move to the floor, that's all.
How are you doing to do justice to that one? Mr. Chair?
Yes. House Bill 3454 exempts from property tax tangible and intangible property rights related to Pacific Northwest AC intertie as referenced between the U.S. Department of Energy and any city of any state. It applies to tax years beginning whenever these agreements were executed or beginning on or after July 1, 2005. As background for this bill, the current law under ORS 307 states that all property of the state and all public or corporate property used or intended for corporate purposes of several counties or cities is exempt from property tax except as provided by law. The law does not exempt property or interests in Oregon that are owned by cities located outside of Oregon. The two city-owned entities that are electricity producers located outside of Oregon have been assessed property taxes on both tangible and or intangible properties, which are part of their contracts with the Pacific Northwest AC Intertie and the U.S. Department of Energy. Oregon's tax court has ruled in favor of the department, which asserted that these properties are taxable because the companies hold a possessory interest in the intertie. The taxable property includes towers, lines, transformers, substations that are publicly owned or privately used or used by a taxable municipal corporation. On April 1st, the Court of Appeals agreed to allow both parties to postpone their oral presentations until the legislature decided whether or not it wished to create a tax exemption that would be retroactive. Contested tax agreements totaled roughly $3.8 million. According to a representative of the Eugene Water and Electric Board, the largest public utility in Oregon, this company has neither an agreement nor possessory interest in the Pacific Northwest intertie. However, it is concerned about retaliatory actions that the state of Washington might take in the future pending the outcome of this bill. And those were some of the issues that were discussed, as a matter of fact, at the initial public hearing, whether there might be retaliatory actions, whether or not the legislature should clarify that policy as to the proper scope. And so those were the issues that were addressed at that time.
Thank you, Ms. Ayala. And I would say for the record that I believe that this does address one of the concerns that you were concerned about, Representative Boquist, and that is that in passing this legislation, we would be addressing the concern of other municipalities outside the state of Oregon. And I think that certainly now that this is all transmitting at the speed of light throughout the world, we need to do something to address this issue. So did you want to speak to this, Representative Boquist, please?
Just one follow-up, Mr. Chair. I mean, this one is slightly more complex than the other one because it's state versus state. And it's actually state versus federal when you get down to it. There are two concerns that really jump to mind. One is the intangible issue again. But what jumps to light is the fact that, you know, we're spending, you know, a tremendous amount of tax dollars, probably close to $1 million, total across the board of like $37,000 in a biennium. And so, you know, here we are in a case where this is really not good public policy. And furthermore, I mean, one of the concerns I had is the testimony that comes out that says, well, let's let the judge decide. I don't think we want to be in a position to have a negative ruling from a judge that will have a long-term impact that we probably won't want to live with. So, again, I think this goes one step towards addressing that issue, but it is not the full solution, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion? Representative Boquist is recognized.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 3454 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
You've heard the motion. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Representative Boquist, will you carry that to the floor?
Delighted.
Thank you
is
very
there
much.
An amendment to this?
No. Oh, is there?
Yeah.
Well,
not anymore.
Well,
not anymore.
The
you would
be
in the
chair. The chair entertain a motion to reopen the.
Would you withdraw
the. Let's see.
I move to reconsider the motion
by which it passed.
By which it passed.
Is there any objection? Hearing seeing none, so ordered. We'll reopen that House Bill. I'm sorry. I'm looking, and there is a dash one amount. I apologize.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I was referring to 3554-1 when I read off the bill. And it didn't change the impacts. It just added an additional clause. If you look at the effect of the amendment, it basically changes the initial phrase that was in the bill that was intangible and tangible property rights related to the Pacific Northwest intertie, and it changes that phrase to include property interests. So you've got intangible and tangible property rights or property interests related to the Pacific Northwest intertie. So there was an additional.
Thank you. I beg your pardon, colleagues. Representative Boquist moves the dash one amendment to House Bill 3454. We've heard the discussion, and that's what it's been. It's about 3454 with the dash one amendment. Is there any discussion further on the dash one? Hearing and seeing none, is there any objection to appending the dash one to House Bill 3454? Seeing no objection, we will append that. And Representative Boquist now moves 3454 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation, amended with the dash one amendment dated 4/11/05. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Representative Boquist, will you carry that amended with the A-1 amendment?
Delightful.
3454A. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 3454. We had 2950 and 2951. Were all the folks here on that one? Okay. You're here, Representative. Okay. In case we have questions, we will now open a work session on House Bill 2950.
Chairman Butler and committee members, with House Bill 2950, we heard this once before, and there was quite a bit of confusion on what exactly current law was in terms of the treatment of these dependent care assistance payments. And originally it was brought to you in light of the dependent care assistance tax credit, but this bill itself is really dealing with payroll taxes, and that's really all it's dealing with. Even though the original bill was amending a 315 statute, it really needed to be amending the unemployment insurance payroll tax statutes. So that's what you have then in your dash two amendment, is it's dealing with the unemployment department's statutes dealing with the unemployment taxes. And it's specifying there that the employment dependent care assistance, which means any payments that they make, an employer makes to its employees for their dependent care to their employees, shall not be included in wages for unemployment compensation purposes. Now, as you can see from the Dash 2 Amendment, you're connecting to an Internal Revenue Code. It's Section 129D of the Internal Revenue Code, and then also the limitations in earned income of Section 129B of the Internal Revenue Code. So I did copy you the Internal Revenue Code. so everyone's clear, this is got a limit in there of $5,000 as far as the amount of employer compensation that they can make per employee for that would be removed from wages for unemployment payroll tax purposes. So this is, and I've worked with the employment department, and they would like it to begin on or after January 1st, 2006, where the original bill began in January 1st, 2005. So that's another change. But basically, what you had in statute is similar to what we were dealing with the Department of Revenue, with having a statute with the dividends deduction exclusion. We thought they thought originally they were connected with federal law in this area, and then they found out that they weren't. So basically, we are trying to get into the unemployment insurance payroll tax statutes and actually specify out there that this child care, dependent care assistance will not be allowed in the wages, so then it will conform with federal law. And that was the testimony you had from a CPA as far as, wanting it to, Oregon state statutes to conform with federal state statutes. So that's what you're getting there. And so everyone's clear also, your credit, your dependent care credit, is 50% of the child care expenses in a given year. So it only goes up to $2,500 is amount that could be part of the dependent care tax credit. But this exclusion will be up to $5,000 because you're connecting to federal legislation and the federal law, which has the limit of $5,000 per employee. And so what you have then in your House Bill 2950-2, you have an other funds tax revenue loss. And that will begin in fiscal year 2005-06. It's a reduction of $54,314 to begin with. And in 2006-07, there's a reduction of $117,535. So for a total for the biennium, upcoming biennium of $171,849. Again, this is assuming a full $5,000 per employee. And the Employment Department will check with some of their other staff who are gone this week to just verify that, yes, that is the correct interpretation of the internal, since we are connecting distinctly to the Internal Revenue Code. But that is our understanding at this point. And so then out in the future bienniums, we're going to see, forecasting in there, a slight increase in the payroll tax rate, basically going from 2.6% to 3% by 2011, as well as the growth then in the expenses that we would be anticipating of people being able to utilize the child care tax credit, as well as then contributing money to child care expenses for their employees. So that's how you get the growth all the way out to 2911 by item of $320,745. But again, this is other funds tax revenue loss.
So those are payroll taxes and the UI.
That's right.
That is. Okay, and we'd heard previously from Tamara Brinkman from the Employment Division. Are there questions of staff regarding the Dash 2 amendments?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hass is recognized.
I guess, is the goals, is this to incent the employers to do more of this?
Well, Chairman Butler and Representative Hass, I think what was brought forward, at least from what I can understand from the first hearing, was that they wanted to conform with federal law, that this was a CPA who had identified this as being a difference between Oregon and state law, and they wanted to simplify the process. So they said, why isn't Oregon conforming? And so then that's how the original bill was written, but the original bill clearly didn't get us there. So, and it began in January 1st, 2005, and it didn't have provisions to have retroactivity in there, so we had to bring it out forward to January 1st, 2006, because this won't be effective until 90 days after the end of session.
So this is basically a whole new bill.
Well, it's a whole new statute, yeah. I mean, and it clarified, it's much clearer exactly what you're doing. And that's why you're sitting there, that's why we're amending 657.115 and clearly specifying in there that these, wages do not include the amount of any payments paid on behalf of, and then it goes through and lists the various exclusions from wages, and then you add independent care assistance. And then you're connecting clearly with the Internal Revenue Code, which was not done originally in this bill. So that clearly makes it at least a little bit clearer exactly what
we're doing. That was attempted in the Dash 1 amendment, but not accomplished.
Yeah, Dash 1 forgot to move it forward. I mean, we didn't have the applicability date January 1st of 2006. That gave it just took effect 90 days after the end of session, and that was the Employment Department felt like they needed some additional months to get their rules and whatnot in order for this.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Harris?
I guess I'm not sure whether the intent here is to incent more employers to provide Medicare care assistance or if it's just simply to simplify their taxes, the tax filing, or if it's to just lower their tax rates. We have a whole new bill, and this is pretty much a different bill, but I guess we started on that. Not that I'm opposed to any of those things. I think it's important to know what the intent is.
Does the department have a response? I don't know that we can try and anticipate how that will affect. Do we have a child care division here?
I don't know.
Yeah, you're it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tamara Brickman. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Employment Department, which houses the Child Care Division. I can't speak to the specific intent of the drafters. What I understand is that we define wages for purposes of payroll taxes in our own chapter of law, Oregon Revised Statutes, Chapter 657. And employers pay unemployment insurance taxes on the first $27,000 in wages. And so if you exclude this and it brings an employee's wages below the $27,000 threshold, it could reduce employers' taxes because they're not paying that state unemployment tax. They currently do not pay the federal unemployment tax on those dollars that they use for dependent care assistance because it is excluded as wages under the federal definition, under the Federal Employment Tax Act. But we aren't directly connected in our statute of law to the Federal Unemployment Tax Act. So if you wanted to basically say it's not considered wages for either purposes of federal unemployment tax and state unemployment tax, this bill is needed for that. Otherwise, what happens is they pay state unemployment tax on these dollars, but not federal unemployment taxes. I don't know that gets to the intent of the bill, but that's what I understand.
Does that change any of the benefits, Tamara?
It does not change the benefits. What it does is it reduces revenue to the trust fund because we're not collecting as it has the potential to reduce revenues, which Ms. Elizabeth had mentioned to you just a bit ago about with respect to how much money we would collect in the trust fund, which is relatively negligible considering the balance of the trust fund.
Actually, this would have an effect of increasing the income tax collections because it's a deductible item by the employer. And so there's a commensurate increase in the...
Well, they're already taking it as a tax credit.
They're not taking it as a deduction. They wouldn't be taking it as a deduction here.
Do you mean the child care expenses?
Yeah, if they're not able to deduct the unemployment, the SUI of $320,000 in 2009-2011, then they're not paying it and they're not deducting it. Therefore, they would pay more income tax in 2000 in each of these years.
Well, Chairman Butler, I'd have to look into that.
Yeah.
I don't know the connection that there's an exclusion of not being able to claim it as a deduction just because you're paying payroll taxes.
If I'm not paying a payroll tax, I'm not deducting it.
Okay. Currently, they're paying a payroll tax.
Right. And if I stop paying a payroll tax,
why wouldn't they be claiming it as a deduction?
Because they're not paying it.
But they're paying it to their employees.
They're not paying an unemployment tax to their employees.
You're just changing the definition of wages. It doesn't change,
the amount that decreases the amount that goes into the trust fund.
Mm-hmm.
That's amount that the employer is not paying on an employee.
Right.
Okay. For the employee's first $27,000 and the child care portion.
Mm-hmm.
To that extent, that they are not paying that into the UI. Then they're not writing out an additional check. By not writing out the additional check, my income goes up. Mm-hmm. My taxable income of the employer mm-hmm. goes up. Mm-hmm. When the taxable income of the employer goes up, then something in a factor of about 8% of this goes back into the...
So you're just meaning the feedback effects? I mean...
The direct feedback effect.
Yeah.
Eight cents on a dollar.
About 8 cents on the dollar. So this increases the general fund slightly. Is that your
less than 50,000 a year.
Paul is shaking his head yes. Did you have something to add to that, representing the course?
Certainly not to that discussion, but really the representative has wanted to know the purpose of the bill. Yes, I agree with everything you've said to my limited understanding of the argument here, and probably anybody in the audience could come forward too. But the purpose of the bill was to... really incent good child care providers and to provide that opportunity to disconnect.
Linda Flores, you're going to have to give your name for the record.
I'm sorry, for the record, Linda Flores, State Representative.
Thank you.
And also to connect the state to the federal code because of the apparent, some of the software tax preparation programs were not acknowledging that particular piece, presuming, with the presumption apparently built into the software that Oregon was connected to the federal code.
This is not the only difference between federal and state SUI and FUI, yeah. But it is certainly one that is probably creates the most aggravation in my experience in payroll preparation, because we see this frequently as an employer fringe benefit, and that's a problem. Other questions, Representative Hass?
No, I thank you, Representative Flores, for making those points. I do support this if the intent is to try and get more of this behavior and not just simply.
Okay, any further discussion? Representative Berger now moves House Bill
the dash two
to House Bill be appended. Any discussion? Is there any objection to appending the dash two amendments to the House Bill 2950? Not so ordered. Representative Flores now moves House Bill 2950 as amended with the dash two amendments under date of Representative Berger.
I move House Bill 2950 to the floor with the, as amended with the dash two amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
You've heard the motion, discussion of the motion. Any objection? Representative discussion?
I would like to vote on this one. Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yeah. We'll have a voice vote on this. Christy?
Representative Boquist?
Yes.
Representative Esquivel?
Yes.
Representative Felicio?
Aye.
Representative Comp?
No.
Representative Riley?
No.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hass?
Aye.
Chair Butler?
Butler votes aye. House Bill 2950 as amended with the dash two amendments will move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Flores, will you carry that, please? Thank you very much. We also now have, we will close the work session on 2950 and open a work session on House Bill 2951.
Okay, Chairman Butler, House Bill 2951 is dealing with the Dependent Care Assistance Tax Credit, and it's dealing with that sunset date. And so under current law, you've got a sunset date on that tax credit of January 1st, 2007. So originally, the bill just eliminated the current law sunset date of January 1st, 2007. You do have a dash one amendment, and that dash one amendment then extends it out 20 years to have the sunset be January 1st, 2027. So again, the revenue impact is just from having that dependent care assistance tax credit continued in the future. By the 2007-09 biennium, it's a negative of roughly $4 million, and the 2009-11 biennium, $4.7
million. Okay. And that's the dash one amendment.
That's dash
and we
one
have
amendment.
Previously addressed, I think the representatives Hass, Galizio, and Olson had previously addressed the issues in a work group related to this matter. But this dash one amendment merely changes the or extends the sunset. Is that correct?
Chairman Butler, that's correct. The dash one just extends the sunset. That's all it does. Just originally, the bill just eliminated the sunset. Okay. This added a sunset date in law.
Discussion relative to the Dash 1 amendment.
I move we append that we add Dash 1 amendment to this bill.
Representative Riley moves that we append the Dash 1 amendment of date 4-1805 to House Bill 2951. Discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Let the record reflect that Representatives Olson and Esquivel are excused for other House business. We have amended 2951 with the Dash 1 amendments. Representative Riley. Representative Riley moves that we move House Bill 2951 as amended with the Dash 1 amendments to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion to your motion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, we will order that to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Riley, would you like that on the consent calendar?
Yes, that'd be great.
Okay, Representative Riley moves that to the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Any objection to Representative Riley's motion to move that to the consent calendar? Hearing and seeing none, so thank you very much. We will close the work session on House Bill 2951. We're well out of time, and I've got, I think Representatives Hass and Berger both have meetings that they're supposed to be at, and I apologize for not getting all the way through. Colleagues, we'll move our schedule to Monday, the unfinished business, Paul. We have them up Friday, these same ones. Okay. Everything we didn't get to today, we have up for Friday. So with that, we will close I had recessed 2995. We're going to close the public hearing on 2995, and we will go ahead and close House Committee on Revenue today. Thank you.